Welcome, everybody. It is a joy to see you all here, and some of you who are coming from far. It's very nice to see you again. As John said, we are going to explore a subject that has been a concern in philosophy and religion, one of the major concerns for philosophers, and especially in Western philosophy and Western religion. That is what is normally called the problem of evil. That is, why is there evil in the world? That there is evil in the world is undeniable. We all have some perception of evil, and we all have some experience of evil. Now, when we are talking about evil, we are talking about a wide range of actions or experiences, not only things that are related to demons or something like that, that sometimes the word evil has that import. But we are talking about evil in a more philosophical sense, and also we will see the religious aspect of it. And so we all have an experience of the existence of evil. And the problem is that when this happens, it generates the feeling, an uneasy feeling, that there is something wrong in the universe, that the universe may not be a rational place after all, or that there is no justice in the universe. So we need a justification. We need, as human beings, to understand why is there evil. Now, there are normally in philosophy two kinds of evil. The one that is produced by human beings, that is sometimes called the moral evil, and the one that is produced by nature, which is the natural evil. By this we mean the causes of suffering. We suffer from other people's actions, or we suffer from nature when there are earthquakes or illnesses or predators. So nature itself produces suffering on us and also other human beings. In philosophy, these two sources of evil or suffering are differentiated. So when trying to explain or to explore this question of evil, there are two avenues to try to explain it. One is the justification of evil in itself. Why is there evil at all in the world, in the universe? But then there is another aspect of the problem, which is prominent in the West, that is what is called the justification of God, or theodicy. And the idea is not only why is there evil, but why is there evil if there is a loving God that created the universe? How come that we have an omnipotent and omnibenevolent God? He's all-powerful, he's omniscient, and yet the universe seems to be flawed because there is evil. So why is this? How can we have evil on one side and an all-loving, all-powerful God on the other? So there are these two aspects, trying to explain the existence of evil and trying to explain the existence of God in the face of evil. So we are going to explore the religious and philosophical answers that are normally given, and then the theosophical view on this. The fact that there is still a debate about this, and it has been there for a few thousand of years, shows that there is not, or they couldn't come up with a good answer. The answers are normally not satisfying from one point of view or the other. So let's see how this is normally answered. In pagan religions, they didn't have this particular problem, the problem of explaining evil, because in their view, there were many gods, and these gods were kind of, they had a human personality, so they would get angry, and they would pick on a person, a human being, if that human being disobeyed them or did something wrong. So the causes of evil were these gods. Some of them were more prone to be loving. Some of them were fast to become angry, and people knew about this, and they tried to propitiate or offer sacrifices to them. So the idea of evil was very easy to explain. They come from the gods, and if you do the right thing, then evil is not going to fall on you. Now, when in Christianity, we postulate a perfect God, an all-loving God, then the explanation of evil becomes more troublesome. Even in the Bible, in the Jewish Bible or the Old Testament, the idea of God is not so much as this, as the Christian idea, let's say. There is a famous verse in Isaiah 45:7, where God says, "I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things." So in Judaism, especially before Christianity, and today, of course, there are many branches that still have this view, but the idea of God was not so much this Christian idea of the perfect, all-loving, unconditionally, you know, committed to humanity God. So it was seen, you can see it even in the book of Job, where it is God, the one that seems to let Satan go and produce all the suffering on Job for no apparent reason. If you try to read the book of Job as an explanation of evil, you get a very dissatisfying answer, and which is actually one of the answers about the nature of evil. There are a group of religious people that say, you just cannot understand God. God is not rationally justifiable. So there is evil just because he wants to or he allows it, and he doesn't have to have any reason for that. And this is based on, for the most part, on the interpretation of the book of Job. Now, in the theosophical view, the book of Job is telling a completely different story, not a justification for evil, but it's talking about a process in the growth of the soul. Last year, my wife gave a talk on that you can find it online under Living Theosophy series, this theosophical view on the book of Job, if you are interested. But if you, as I said, interpret that as an explanation for evil, then you don't get any rationally satisfying answer. So then, if we look at God from the normal Christian point of view, the existence of evil produces two challenges. The first one is the challenge to God's omnipotence. So you can say there is evil in the world, in the universe, just because God couldn't prevent it. He tried to create a perfect universe, a perfect humanity, and Satan somehow, you know, messed things up, and he couldn't prevent it. So that's one explanation. But then, if that is the case, God is not omnipotent. The other challenge is the challenge to the idea of omnibenevolence. Maybe God could prevent the evil because he's omnipotent, but he didn't want to. For what reason? Well, we will see, but the idea is that he didn't want to. So this challenges the idea that he's an all-loving God, because if you create a machine, for example, you create it so that it works perfectly. Your aim in creating a machine is that it can fulfill its purpose. You won't create a flawed machine on purpose. So why would God create a universe that has this intrinsic flaw, which is evil and suffering? If he's all-powerful, if he's loving, he would create these creatures to live in harmony and peace. So, you know, the idea is that, well, he actually did try to create that. Adam and Eve in the, you know, paradise, they were like that, but then Satan made them fall. And the problem then is that humanity chose the path of evil. So some of the justification for evil is tied to the concept of free will. It's not that God wanted evil for us, but he gave us free will. Now, this concept is also challenged in the sense that free will has to do with freedom of choice. Now, it's perfectly fine to have freedom of choice, but why didn't God, who created us and could have created us in any way, why didn't he create us with wisdom so that we would choose the right path? If you see Adam and Eve, they seem to be more than, not so much wise or intelligent, they seem to be innocent. They were created with innocence, and therefore they were tricked by Satan. And they after they ate the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, only then they acquired the ability to discern between good and evil. Not before. And then they recognized themselves that they were naked, so they recognized their own humanity, their own individuality. So in the story, if you take literally the story of the Genesis, then Adam and Eve are created as innocent children, and when they make a mistake, that produces evil for the whole humanity, the original sin, that then every one of us are, you know, carrying over, and that is the source of evil. So that is not satisfying either. If God wanted to give us free will, he could have given us also wisdom along with that. So Irenaeus, that was an early theologian, he had an idea that is closer to the theosophical view, although it's not complete, and therefore it doesn't really solve all the problems. But he said there is evil because it is necessary for the growth of the soul. It is necessary so that human beings become moral agents, so that human beings can become good by their own effort, by their own endeavor. If there is not the temptation of evil, then there is no value in being good. You are good just because you don't have any other option. And that's a rational point. The problem here, the criticism here, comes with the idea of the eternal damnation or punishment in hell. So you create these human beings that you give them, you put them among temptations, you give them certain amount of intelligence and free will so that they can choose to become good people. But if God is omniscient, God knows for each soul if that soul is going to succeed or not in their endeavors to be good people. Otherwise, God cannot be omniscient. This is the third challenge to the concept of omniscience. So if God is all-knowing, what? Didn't he know that this person in this condition wasn't going to be able to do the right thing? And if he did, then why is there the challenge and why is there the punishment for all eternity? You know, you can put your children in a certain situation where you want them to learn, but then whether they learn or not, you are not going to punish your children for all eternity just because they weren't able to do it. So these are the normal criticisms that the religious view has from philosophers and from thinkers, even within the religion. Now, the problem here is this particular idea of God that is not the only idea of God in Christianity. If you see, and we are going to mention this a little later, but if you see the idea of God in the mystics, then you have a completely different situation with a different idea of God, which already exists in Christianity. The question of evil, that doesn't even appear. The question of evil itself is a wrong question. Therefore, it doesn't have an answer because the question itself is wrong, as we are going to explore. But if with this particular idea of God, the question of evil cannot be answered. You will always run into contradictions, which is what happened, you know, for a couple of thousands of years. So as long as we see God as an external entity, external to the universe, with a an individual power of decision, and that he could intervene if he wants to, and he doesn't, you know, when there is a calamity. As long as we have that idea, it's very difficult to explain evil. So let us try to see a different perspective and see if from this perspective we can understand the idea of divinity and the idea of evil and how they fit in the experience of being a human being. First, we have to explore a little more in depth the nature of evil. What is evil? So far we have taken one assumption, that is the regular assumption. In philosophers, in religious people, the assumption is evil is suffering. But is that true? Can we say evil is suffering? Aren't there many instances in which suffering is actually a means to produce a greater good? For example, when a good, loving parent, is raising his or her child, many times he or her has to do something that will produce a certain suffering for the child. But this is done for a greater good. It's so that this person can develop to the full extent of his or her potentialities. So suffering many times is a means for a greater good. Or even a surgery. A surgery is hurting the body, is producing suffering, is disrupting the whole balance in the body. But if the surgery is necessary to cure an illness, then it is done for a greater good. So suffering is not directly equated with evil. And same with pleasure. We know that there are many things that produce an immediate pleasure, and they are evil for the body or for the mind. And many vices or drugs or bad habits in any field of our human life, they may produce an immediate pleasure and be something really bad for us. So when we look into this, we begin to see that evil is something not so easily defined. Then if we want to define or to say these are evil actions and these are not, again, if we look a little deeper into this, we will see that it's not easy to come to a clear view. Probably we all agree that what is going on in Syria with ISIS is something evil in the sense of wrong. But many of them, I'm sure, they think that they are fighting for a holy cause and that they are doing the right thing. After all, the Catholic Church or the Christian Church, you know, also did that. There were many holy wars, and there are theologians justifying war in the name of a holy cause. And even many of the military interventions of the U.S. Army are seen in other countries as an evil action, and on this side are seen as something good that we are doing for the sake of people. So when you start looking at what we call evil actions, we start seeing that on a personal level, some things may be very clear. For us, it may be very clear this is evil. But on a more general level, it's not so clear because people will have different perceptions. So the thing is that we tend to relate evil with whatever we don't like, whatever we don't approve, whatever causes suffering to us, and good to whatever we like or produces joy, expansion. So we tend to interpret evil in this way, and that is a fundamental flaw in our understanding of the universe. Because when we see evil in terms of personal likes and dislikes, then that in itself produces conflict. That in itself produces intolerance. And we are going to see a little more about that later. So in order to understand what evil really is, we have to go back to the beginning of things, to the beginning of the very beginning of the universe, and see what the root of what we call evil is. In the theosophical view, the universe was not created by an entity that generates a universe outside, a creation outside of himself. The idea in the theosophical view is that there is a principle, that is a unity, that embraces or that has in itself everything in a potential way. For example, it could be compared with the zero, the number zero, which has all the numbers within, plus one and minus one, you have zero, or plus two and minus two, you have zero. All the numbers are within, potentially, in a harmonized way, and they are synthesized in this all potential source of numbers. Zero in itself is neither good nor evil, neither positive nor negative, and yet it's a source of any possible number in the universe. So the idea is that there, in theosophy, is that there is one single principle from which or within which everything, the whole cosmos, with every single polarity, is going to be generated. In Neoplatonism, which was a philosophy during the early years of the Christian tradition, they also had this idea, the idea of the one that they called the good. They called the one the good, not because it's the good as opposed to the evil, it's the good because in the state of oneness, there is no room for evil, there is no room for strife or differences. So they call it the one, and they call it the good. Now, as we are going to see, I think that the basic mistake in the conception of God that the early Christian thinkers made is that they related their idea of God with this one that was the good, and they thought, okay, so God, because Christianity was very influenced by Neoplatonism. This is a historical fact. And many of the early fathers of the church were Neoplatonists. So they identified God with the good, but they identified God with the good as opposed to whatever is evil. That is not the original idea in the Neoplatonic principle of the one. The one embraces everything. And we are going to see how that produces some problems later on. So the idea is that you have this one principle which, in the process of manifestation of the universe, produces within itself a polarization. And within itself, the duality of good and evil, you and me, high and low, creation and destruction, everything, all this polarity begins to operate in the universe. Now, you see that the one principle, the good, is beyond this polarity. It's beyond good and evil. It embraces everything. So this principle of polarity is the origin of conflict. Madame Blavatsky, the founder of the Theosophical Society, talking about this, and the Pythagoreans that were the disciples of Pythagoras, she says the Pythagoreans hated the binary, the principle of two. With them, it was the origin of differentiation, hence of contrast, discord, or matter, the beginning of evil. So the idea is that once you generate this duality, you generate this differentiation, conflict starts. Because you have now building forces and destructive forces. You have light and shadow. And one and the other, they clash with each other. So the idea is that this duality begins to produce the differentiation and the strife between different things. And the mistake that I was talking about that was done by the early Christian thinkers is that they related God to one of these two poles. Because evil has no place within God. Satan is something separate. So by making evil something separate, opposed to God, evil ceases to have a place in the universe. Evil is something that cannot simply be there. It's not part of God. So when you look at the universe with the idea that evil is out of place, it has no rightful role in the universe, then you come to all the problem of explaining then why it is there. But if you follow this other view, as we are going to do, you will see that evil is not bad. Evil is not something that should not be there. Evil is an intrinsic part of the universe, and it would be better to call it with another name, because for us, evil is, by definition, something that should not be there. But you will see that what we call evil is an intrinsic part of the universe, and it's something without which the universe could not exist. So the idea is that these opposing forces that pervade the universe are the ones that keep the universe growing and that keep the universe in balance. Madame Blavatsky says, in the cosmos, the equilibrium between these two forces is preserved. The operations of the two contraries produce harmony. We can see in our body, for example. Suppose, take our body as the whole cosmos. In our body, we have two kind of activities. The metabolism is formed by two kinds of activities. What is called anabolism, that are the building forces, the forces that build, you know, cells and muscle and make you grow. And then you have the catabolism, that are the destructive forces, the forces that break down proteins to produce energy, that break down old structures so that a new structure can appear there. If there is no forces of destruction, then there is no growth possible. We would be frozen in one static frame or state, because you need to break down in order to change, to improve, to expand. So in a healthy organism, these two forces are in balance, and they are working in a harmonious way, and they produce the growth of the body. So in a healthy body as a whole, you see how these two forces are essential for the existence of the body. Now, if you go to the part, if you look at the cells that are at this moment being destroyed, then you will say, that is evil. There is something wrong going on there. When you lose sight of the whole and you look at the part, then you lose a perspective and you say, there is destruction here, this is evil. That is what happens in the universe. The whole universe, the building forces and the destructive forces, are essential for the working and growth and expansion and evolution of the universe. Now, when we look at the part without having an awareness of the whole, then we can be fooled into thinking that something is wrong. Now, we are going to talk about, because this doesn't mean that there is nothing like moral evil. We are going to talk about that, the evil that is produced by human beings. But first, I'm talking about evil as a principle in the universe, which we cannot call evil, because it's not something wrong. So these two forces, these opposing forces, and when you see how a solar system is formed, you see always this clashing of forces and the sun trying to swallow planets and the planets trying to keep away from the sun. And all these conflicting forces generate a solar system. Without them, then the whole universe would be just a formless mass of atoms spread uniformly everywhere around. So you cannot generate any form. Now, in human beings, we too have this polarity. Blavatsky said, in human nature, evil denotes the polarity of matter and spirit, a struggle for life between the two manifested principles in space and time. These principles, however, are one per se, because they are rooted in the absolute. So what we call spirit and matter, they are two aspects of this one principle of the good that we were talking about. And matter has a particular action, and spirit has the opposite action. But a human being is what it is because of the interaction of these two principles. It is only by the interaction of these two opposing forces that we can generate a center of consciousness. So the idea is that in this one universal principle, there are many divine sparks, seeds of divine consciousness, that through a process of evolution will develop, awaken, and express all the potentialities that are there. The idea in the theosophical view is not that there is a God that generates fully blown human beings, but a process in which the divine spark little by little develops and awakens by a natural process of growth. So the purpose in evolution is that these divine sparks are divine, but they are unconscious. Then by becoming many and by getting entangled with matter, they become conscious, but they become conscious of separation. Now these sparks think, I am this, and I'm separate from there. Now, this separation is essential to produce consciousness. And that is the point that we have to understand. Consciousness only works through contrast. If, for example, you are sitting on your chair and you become aware of your body only when there is a feeling that appears, and maybe a pain or ache or something that appears and produces a contrast in your consciousness and you notice your body. If everything is fine, you are unconscious of your body. If here there is a smell that is constant, we may sense the smell as soon as we enter the room, but when we stay here, then we stop sensing the smell unless it changes. Consciousness only works through contrast, through change. So in order to generate consciousness in the divine spark, there has to be a contrast, a separation, me and you, good and evil, heat and cold. All these contrasts generate what we call consciousness. And then the process of evolution, after it generated these divine sparks that are conscious of separation, leads them into a consciousness of the unity. So we come from unconscious unity, go to conscious separation, and then go back to conscious unity. So it is inevitable in the process of evolution that contrast and strife will happen, especially in the human kingdom, which is when Adam and Eve eat the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. Animals, because they don't have consciousness in the sense that we do, they are developing that kind of consciousness, they are part of nature. They are part of the what the universe produces, or the laws of God, if you want to see it that way. And there is no conflict there. It is in human beings with our ability to have a freedom of thought, of will and a freedom of thought, it is in human beings that we become aware of conflict. And this is the foundation for the only thing that perhaps we can call evil, that is the moral evil. So far we have seen how evil doesn't exist in the universe. There are just forces that build and destruct, but they are all necessary. But human beings can be producers of a certain kind of disruption that we could call evil. Let me read one quote from one of the Blavatsky, the teachers of Madame Blavatsky. He says, "The real evil proceeds from human intelligence, and its origin rests entirely with reasoning man, who disassociates himself from nature. Humanity, then, alone is the true source of evil. Evil is the exaggeration of good, the progeny of human selfishness and greediness. Think profoundly and you will find that safe death, which is no evil but a necessary law, and accidents that will always find their reward in the future, the origin of every evil, whether small or great, is in human action, in man whose intelligence makes him the one free agent in nature." There are several things there, but let me focus on our topic. The idea is that the universe as a whole, in the universe as a whole, these two forces work in harmony, and they produce or maintain the universe working. Now, human beings have free will. Therefore, they have the ability to do something that is opposed to the normal or to the harmonious working of the whole. We can decide, whether consciously or unconsciously, to go against what the universe needs at the time. The idea in the theosophical view is that there is a purpose in evolution. There are some goals that the universe is trying to attain on the different stages. Animals cannot decide to go against those goals. Human beings can. We can decide to go against it. And that, what evil, becomes whatever is against the direction of the whole. So that is the true or the esoteric definition of evil. It's whatever action made by a part that goes against the whole. So, for example, at a certain point in human evolution, the goal of evolution was to become material. We start as spiritual sparks, and in order to generate consciousness, we need to take on a material force, a form. It is only through this material form that separates us from the rest that we can develop this sense of I am this. Now, it is said in The Secret Doctrine, one of the books that Madame Blavatsky wrote, that there were some souls that did not want to become material. They were on the spiritual planes, they were in meditation, they were in a spiritual state, and when the law said you have to become material, they said, no way, we are not going to incarnate in these bodies with all the limitation and all the suffering, we will stay spiritual. And that, it is said in The Secret Doctrine, was a mistake. And then the law of karma that we are going to mention briefly produced or made them incarnate later in worse conditions. But you see, at that point in the development of the universe, the law was to become material. And those human beings or human souls that decided not to do it did something that was wrong, that was evil. At this point in evolution, we are already incarnated. We have already developed a strong sense of personal self, and the evolution is going in the opposite way. The evolution is bringing us now from consciousness of separation to a consciousness of unity. We have to spiritualize ourselves. So any action that goes against that, that goes towards being more material or being more separate, is an action that is evil or that is wrong. So you see, evil is something relative because it's simply the disharmony with the whole. If the whole is going this way and we are going the other way, we are producing a disturbance. So that is the only definition of evil that really makes sense and that we can grasp. So whatever a person or a group of people are doing, if that is going against what the universe is trying to produce, then yes, it is an evil action. Now, of course, there is a reason for all this. It's not, even though there is this evil, it's not that this evil is out of place. So we are going to close the presentation with this particular concept. The idea is that suffering itself is necessary in the process of evolution. Although it is not intended, it is inevitable and it is necessary. It is just like if you are teaching somebody to ride a bicycle, you don't intend that person to fall. You want that person to learn how to ride the bicycle. But you know that the person, it's inevitable that the person will fall. And in trying to learn not to fall, is how he will learn to ride the bicycle. If you are constantly holding the bicycle, then the person will never learn to keep the balance. So although you don't intend for the person to fall, that is inevitable and it's necessary in the process of learning. So suffering is the same. Suffering is never intended, but it is inevitable. And it is actually necessary. If not for suffering, we would be stuck in in an awareness of our separation, and we will never transcend this very limited awareness of ourselves. You know, if we were perfectly fine being this, why would we care or make an effort in trying to change, in trying to expand or to, you know, discover something deeper? If you see pleasure produces inertia, produces inactivity. When there is pleasure, then there is a complete inactivity. You know, we are fine with that. We don't want anything else. We don't want to do anything. When there is suffering, then we need to change. That's something that says there is something that has to be changed. And that gives us the energy to look for something else. So suffering is what keeps us going and trying to transcend what we are already. And also suffering is what is telling us that something is wrong. Because when we burn our hand, it hurts, we learn that that is something we shouldn't do. So in daily life also, suffering is an indication that something is wrong. And even if our personal self cannot understand it, in the theosophical view, the soul, after the physical life is over, the soul, which is far on its own plane, is far wiser than the soul when it is incarnated, the soul learns about all this. A lot of the suffering that we may not understand right now will be understood when we return to our own nature. So suffering itself is a teacher. So the soul, when the soul comes back and keeps on this process of learning and growing, it will come as wiser. So as you can see, even though suffering is not intended, it is necessary in the development of a human being. So the idea is that since human beings are free agents and are able to produce a disturbance in the harmony of the whole, there is an inbuilt mechanism in the universe that restores the balance. And that is the law of karma. When we human beings produce a disturbance in the whole, then that generates an effect that will come back and will tend to restore the harmony, and that is experienced by us as suffering. So this mechanism is what keeps human beings from going, you know, from destroying the universe, metaphysically speaking. If we had no way to be checked in our free will, we could do terrible things. We already do things that are quite bad, but we could do even worse things. So the universe has this mechanism in which we are given free will, but at the same time, there is a checking mechanism so that we cannot go too far. And in this mechanism, or within this mechanism, we grow. So it's not a question of punishment when we do something evil. It's not that we are being punished because of the evil that we did. It's just a natural reaction to our own action. And that suffering is what teaches. So the idea is that you can explain the nature of evil and the presence of evil in the world as something that is necessary, is inevitable, and without denying that there is a divine consciousness. That divine consciousness cannot intervene in the suffering, because if it intervenes and prevents the experience of suffering, it is actually preventing the possibility of growth. And the reason why the universe is manifested is so that these divine sparks can develop and evolve and develop all the potentialities. So intervening, preventing the effect of suffering, is actually preventing the possibility of growth. So this explains how there can be a divine consciousness, how the ultimate aim of that divine consciousness can be rooted in love and wisdom, and yet how suffering needs to be there, not to test the soul, not to punish it, but because it's an inevitable result of the process of growth. And the idea is that this process of suffering, it's only in a very little or a very small cycle within the whole cycle of the evolution of the soul. We are right now in the state in which suffering is, but before eons before this state, there was no suffering, and eons after this state, there will be no suffering. There is only suffering as long as we are identified with the part and not with the whole. Remember, if you have the body, and the body is a totality, if you are focused on the cells that are being destroyed at the moment, you see that as evil. You see that as suffering. If you identify yourself with the whole body, that is never perceived as suffering. Right now, many things are being destroyed in your body. But because you have an awareness of the whole, that doesn't produce suffering. If you could identify yourself with those cells that are being destroyed, you would be experiencing suffering. So the same at the level of the cosmic consciousness. Because we are focused on the part, we perceive suffering. The more we identify ourselves with the whole, the experience of suffering ceases to be. And as we identify with the whole, our free will stops going against the harmony of the whole, and therefore we don't generate any karma that will bring back suffering. So suffering is a necessary stage as long as we stick or cling to the separated consciousness. And that is the purpose of this stage of evolution. The more we identify with the whole, the more we go beyond suffering. So that's more or less what I wanted to share with you. Of course, there are many subjects that are related to this, but I wanted to concentrate on these particular aspects. As usual, we can go through question and answer. So if you have any comment
on the surface level, also what you're saying is that, you know, contemporary mantra, you know, of looking at things is the glass half full or half empty. And of course, we should all look at it as being half full. But what you're doing is giving purpose to the times when we actually should view or need to acknowledge at least that the glass is half empty. So I just found it amazing, like the view of suffering as a tool or as anything negative as a tool. And rather than hog the microphone, I had some questions about like the atrophy of or the evil. Well, I'll do it right now while I do have the microphone. Okay. But I just, things that are evil, like natural destruction, but then people getting caught in that. Can you talk a little bit of, you know, people getting caught in an avalanche? Or, I mean, is that then where karma is coming? It's a natural evil that is happening for a forest fire or something like that. Mm-hmm. Speak to that, please.
Yeah. So let me first address your first comment. Yes, I think that attitude we have about suffering, regarding suffering, which produces a lot of problems, comes from the concept that we have of God. Because we have the concept that God is good and evil is something separate and that is opposed to God and that has no place, then naturally suffering has no place in our life. So when something bad happens to us, we say, what have I ever done to deserve this? When something good happens to us, we rarely say, what have I ever done to deserve this? We take ownership of that. Of course I deserve the good. But when suffering in our life, when we are not able to integrate suffering in our lives, that produces far more distress. Of course, suffering is hard. Nobody likes it. I'm not saying that is easy, that we should be masochist and look for suffering, but it is part of the experience of life. If we don't learn to relate to suffering and to see it as part of the experience of life that has a purpose, it's not, suffering doesn't come to me to destroy me, to hurt me, to do something wrong, like if Satan is coming to produce suffering. Suffering is as much or even more of a friend that happiness. Happiness are the moments of rest that we obviously need, but it is through the difficulties, through the strife, that we really grow. So if we can start understanding the role of suffering, and we see that it has a purpose, it's far easier to relate to suffering. We will never like it, but it's easier to relate to suffering and to try to accept it and deal with it. So in the same way, I think if we have the concept of God as something that integrates both aspects, that produces a different view of life. And this concept is found, as I mentioned, in some of the Christian mystics, especially in the concept of the Godhead or the Godhood. It's like a more abstract God that is beyond the personal God that most people know. So the very fact of acknowledging the role of suffering helps us. And this is actually a psychological technique that is being rediscovered by modern psychology. And they see that when we can change our interpretation of the things that happen, that very changing of the interpretation already produces a release of conflict. There is always some conflict there, you know, when we are suffering, but the very changing of the interpretation produces an important release. And then the second one that you were talking about, when there is a natural catastrophe and there are people that are caught in that and they die, yes, the idea is that everything works within karma. And karma, again, is far more flexible than what we tend to think. It's not that a person died in an avalanche and that means that in a previous one he produced an avalanche and killed some person. Things are much more flexible. Many times, because we are all related to each other and because, ultimately speaking, we are not an individual, we are part of the whole, many things that come to us were not necessarily produced by us. But then there is a whole process of like retribution in which all the unmerited suffering that we have in a particular life will produce in the next life some advantages that we had not generated before. And we may say, oh, the next life I won't remember. Well, the next life you will feel yourself as much as you feel yourself this life. You probably said the same in the previous life. And now you are suffering or enjoying something as a result of that. So karma, keeping in mind that karma is more flexible than what we normally assume, yes, everything it comes within karma. Now again, the aspect of ourselves that is affected by karma is the aspect that is the part that is not really the our true nature. The part that is our true nature, that is one with the whole, is never affected by karma. So the more we identify with that, the less we are really affected by it.
I understand your concept of suffering, but I really don't understand evil. Is there actually any evil? And how would you define evil?
Mm-hmm. Yes, as I said, at the level of the universe or nature, I don't think there is any evil or anything that we could call evil. At the human level, if we want to talk about evil, I would say that evil is or are those actions that we produce that go against the direction of the whole. So it's an abstract concept that can explain many things. If the aim of life is to further a sense of communion, is to stimulate our identification with the spiritual nature, if the aim of life at this moment in evolution is to transcend the sense of selfishness, then if we had not free will, we would be doing that spontaneously. Now, because as the animals follow nature spontaneously. Now, because we have free will, we can go against that purpose. So when we go against that purpose, that is an evil action. Whatever is going against the universal purpose. Of course, many times we go against the universal purpose because we are ignorant. So it's not that in the theosophical view, evil is a result of ignorance, not the result of sin or an ill intention, ultimately speaking. We do foolish things because we don't have enough wisdom. If a person that is killing another person could really see the results of that of those actions and could really see the unity that is behind and how he's hurting himself, he would never do that. So he does it because he is profoundly ignorant of certain things at the spiritual level, not at the level of information. So the idea is that evil is whatever goes against the flow of the universe and is a result of ignorance. Therefore, developing wisdom is a way to defeat evil.
I wonder if you would expand just briefly on the concept of, you describe spirit attached to matter. We are the divine spark attached to the physical, to our density, our physical density. And you said, I believe, that spirit is the opposite of matter. And I'm trying to wrap my head around that concept a bit. I understand the difference between spirit and matter, and I understand the law of opposites. So I'm trying to, if you wouldn't mind, please expound just briefly on how spirit is opposite matter, mm-hmm. please.
Yes. In the theosophical view, as Blavatsky said in that quote, spirit and matter are like the two ends or the two extremes of one single principle. So they are the two poles of a single principle. So spirit is when you look at this principle that we have, we call human being, on one, from one side, and matter from the other. Again, these are, when you study theosophy, you will see that there are many concepts that are abstract, because, for example, whenever you define a concept, you are limiting that concept. For example, if I tell you, you know what a triangle is, you all will say yes. And if I tell you, draw a triangle, you will draw a triangle. Now, when I asked you, you were not thinking in any particular triangle. You know the abstract concept of a triangle. When you have to draw it, you have to choose one of the millions of triangles that you could write. So that concept, abstract concept that embraced any possible triangle now becomes one single triangle. So the same with the theosophical concepts, they tend to be abstract because they cover the different possibilities, and then you can apply them to a particular case. So this idea that matter and spirit are like the two poles of a single principle can be applied in many ways. Now, let me, for example, we have in the seal of the Theosophical Society, we have this double triangle. One is black and the other is white. So the idea is that the black triangle represents matter, which is in a process of becoming more and more material, denser. And then the white triangle represents spirit that is in a process of becoming less material, less concrete, less objective. Now, if you see in the seal, they are interlaced. That is a symbol for the human being. In our constitution, you have two kind of tendencies, the one that tends to separation and the one that tends to unity. There are aspects in our nature that are pushing us to be selfish, to be self-serving, to be self-centered. This is because our vehicles of consciousness, the for example, the body, we know it in science. It is said that our body has a tendency for self-preservation. So when there is a conflict, the instinctive biological tendency is to kill and not be killed. That's something that is ingrained in the body and that is necessary. Now, the spirit tends to do the opposite, because the spirit sees the unity of everything and sees that any form is an expression of its own, of the same spirit, the same universal spirit, the spirit would never choose to hurt one part over the other. It's like, you know, hurting one finger to defend the other finger. All fingers are yours. So we have in ourselves these two tendencies. Our bodies are big vehicles of consciousness, the physical, the emotional, the mental. They are animated by lives that are in the process of becoming a separate center of consciousness. So that's the tendency that goes, that is coming towards separation. And our consciousness, our human consciousness, which is using those vehicles of expression, is having the tendency to go back to unity. So we have this clash in ourselves, which is how we both develop the elemental lives that are going down, develop by fighting our consciousness, and we develop by fighting their consciousness. It's just like when, if you want to develop a muscle, you have to put some weight and you have to struggle with the weight so that you can develop the muscle. So the same with consciousness, because consciousness is based on contrast, you can only develop consciousness by being exposed to this contrast. Now, at a certain point, you transcend consciousness. At a certain point, you enter in a state that is of non-consciousness. You can say it's the annihilation of personal consciousness or consciousness as you know it. You can say it is a universal consciousness, whatever name you put it. At a certain point, you go beyond consciousness. And at that point, you go beyond contrast, beyond conflict. So the idea that matter and spirit are opposite can be seen in this way. The spirit is trying to become one, and the material aspect is trying to become one separate. In the Theosophical Society seal, you have in the center the Ankh, which is a circle on top of a cross. The cross is generally the symbol of matter. The circle is the symbol of the spirit. So this means that out of the struggle between these two principles comes the perfect human being, or the heavenly man, in which the spirit is ruling over matter. So it's out of that struggle that the divine human being appears.
You spoke of the evil being something that disrupts the flow of harmony. How do we know what the flow of harmony is so that we can be in accordance with it?
Yes. The real answer, I mean, as far as I can see, is developing discernment, developing spiritual wisdom. And that, for that, is that is the purpose of the whole spiritual life. Now, if you want more of a recipe or something like that, or something that can help us, Annie Besant used to say, for example, anything that goes against love is going against the harmony, because at this point in evolution, what we call love, that is this tendency to unite, is the aim of evolution. So maybe you can use that as a help, but then, you know, it's difficult to... Anyway, you need certain spiritual wisdom to know how love can apply here or there. Or you can say anything that contributes to unity is something that is more possibly in tune with the flow of evolution, and what goes to separation goes against it. But the idea is that by the very effort, by asking that question, and the very effort to figure out the answer, we develop our spiritual wisdom. So it doesn't matter if we get to the right answer. Again, mistakes are not bad. Mistakes are part of the process of growing. Mistakes are not the result of evil. So we should not be afraid of making mistakes, as long as we are honest. You know, you try to figure something out with all your honesty, and then you act on that. And you may be right or you may be wrong. That doesn't make a lot of difference. What makes the difference is your effort to discover. So if you were wrong, then that experience will teach you, and you will develop more spiritual wisdom. And when we produce mistakes with a good intention, the suffering that comes is a suffering that generates wisdom. It's a suffering that can be faced in a different way than when we generate a mistake out of ill will, you know, that we didn't try to do the best that we could. So again, you know, the idea of suffering, mistakes, things out of place, they are all part of life, and they are all good. What we have to try to keep in mind is that we do the best we can. Even if the best we could is not good enough, that doesn't matter.
Thank you for giving me a second.
No problem.
It would seem to me that the definition of evil, and then you, I had this thought to share and ask you about, and then you started to address it. It isn't, maybe it isn't necessarily the going against the flow of the majority, or how, I can't remember how
evolution.
You put it. Right.
Yeah,
but because the unfortunate thing, it seems like to some of us in society that, you know, more and more of society is, the flow is reversing, so that there would be more of what we all in this room might call evil, but the masses are going the opposite direction. So maybe it needs to, the definition needs to revolve more around love, or a definition of something like that, the opposite of love, or I don't know, maybe you would frame
yes.
it better or something.
Yes, in whatever way, you know, it helps you to see it. I mean, for the answer that I gave, you know, whatever goes along with evolution, for that answer to be meaningful, then obviously you have to be familiar with the concept of evolution as presented in the theosophical teachings in particular, because I'm talking from that point of view. But as you say, the idea of love or unity is something that is more easily grasped. And I think that is a good way of looking at this. Now, within, you know, there are cycles in which it is expected that most people will go against the law of love, let's say. You can even see it in a human, in one life, the life of a human being. Generally, when we get to the teen years, we become naturally more selfish or self-centered, and we lose sensitivity for other people. And that's part of the process of growing, because at that point, there is a concentration of consciousness on itself to define, to build its own separate expression. You know, when you were a kid, you were a reflection of your parents. Then at a certain point, there is a need for this self-centeredness, and to define you as a center of consciousness. And then when you go through that stage, then you start bouncing off the environment and readjusting your consciousness so that it can be in harmony with the environment. So you wouldn't say that a teenager is evil in the sense that it may be selfish, but it's part of the process. It may produce suffering and conflict, but it's part of the process. And, you know, but you could say that a person is evil if it is an adult that is supposed to be a little more mature and it still reacts as a teenager. So you would say, well, this is wrong. The teenager is fine, it's part of the process, but this is something wrong, out of place. So in that sense, evil depends on the context, on what particular aim of evolutionary aim that stage has in that sense.
So would you say that something like the situation we have in the world now with ISIS, would you say that something like that is sort of part of the evolution, such as the Christian Crusades were back when those were happening? Mm-hmm. Is that just like an evolving circular kind of thing that the earth goes through?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, anything is part of the process of evolution. Now, we have free will, and we can determine how much suffering we have to go through until we understand. So we as humanity, within a certain limit, I think we have the freedom to choose whether to be stubborn and keep going in one direction and generating more suffering until finally we will get it, or we could go not so much in that direction and we would get to the point without going through so much suffering. So whatever is going on there, as in many other places, unfortunately, is something that you would say is not necessary, it's not inevitable. We could choose not to take that route, but the fact that we are taking it as humanity means that we don't have the wisdom not to do it, so it's necessary. So the very fact that we are doing it means that we don't know any better. So potentially it would not be necessary, but in fact it is necessary, and that will, and the suffering that produces to the whole humanity eventually will teach this is not the way. You know, maybe just like what happened with the atomic bomb. After all that, we saw, well, no, we cannot do this. And that was easier to understand because it was so bad that it was more patent. These little wars that we have since the beginning of history, we are like used to them and we cannot see the lesson behind. But as I said, when the souls are in the post-mortem process, they understand everything far better. The problem is that when they incarnate again, it's difficult to retain that knowledge, and the spiritual path is part of the training of our bodies so that we can retain that knowledge. But eventually that will happen.
Less a question as to seeing some of these ideas and bringing them together. And I kind of am stuck a little bit on is glass empty and glass full. It's just a half a glass. It's not full or empty. We need to see that. And like with a forest fire, well, some trees and things, and we need to burn the subgrowth and stuff to produce different types of trees and different types of land. So the fire isn't, a forest fire isn't evil, but if it's been created by someone whose intention was to destroy people's homes or to destroy everything he could, well, he's on the wrong path. And when I like what you were saying about the ISIS, that we haven't learned to, and we keep doing it over and over again, and I keep seeing that in all the places, you know, all the people that are dying everywhere and everywhere. In Africa before, the wars and one group killing another group, we just are so stuck on not learning that. I wish that there would be some wisdom and hope that wisdom can come someday.
Yeah. Now, if you look at life, I mean, we all engage in little wars in our daily life. It's not so easy. The reason why there are wars there is because it's very difficult to respond to aggression or what we perceive as aggression, to respond in a different way. You know, in our daily life, we enter in conflict, we try to impose our ways, and that is not different from what happens at the level of countries. So it's not an easy lesson to learn, because it requires to transcend the personal self. So unfortunately, that will go on for some more years. I don't know for how many, but we can trust that with all this, the souls are learning, and eventually, little by little, we will discover ways to dealing with all this without so many wars. If you look at the past, you know, now there is diplomacy and all that many times fails, but sometimes it can prevent some wars. And though the diplomacy is flawed because it's based on selfishness, at least it's an improvement of trying to get to come to terms by reasoning. Before, when there were all kingdoms, probably, I don't know that much of history, but I have the impression that there was nothing like that. It was just war. So maybe we are improving little by little, finding out new ways to deal with each other. And that is exactly the purpose in the Theosophical Society. When the founders created the organization, they said, okay, this should be a place where we have to try to relate to each other by different means than the world. We have to relate to each other based on the principle of brotherhood. So to me, that is the most important aspect of the Theosophical Society. But then when we are in our lodges, when we are in the groups, and there are conflicts, how aware we are that we should try to deal in a different way. Many times, because we are humans, we relate to that in the same way that humanity does, you know, by trying to impose our way or by fighting or arguing. So the challenge begins in our very life, and if we can learn how to relate in our daily life to conflict in a different way, then that will generate an awareness in the world that will help the world change.
My question is that if God is omniscient, or the One is omniscient, why does it need to be self-actualized by having parts of itself split off and suffer under the illusion of separateness?
Mm-hmm. Well, when HPB was asked that question, she said, I'm not in speaking terms with God or the Absolute, so you go and ask it. But the idea is that we can, and I'll give you my view on this, but there is a plane in which answers cannot really explain. There is a level of questions that cannot be explained with an answer, simply because they may not have a reason as human beings understand. So, for example, I always put this example. If a person would ask you, why do you love somebody? Real love, not desire and attachment. Why do you love somebody? When you love somebody, you suffer if that person suffers. You sacrifice yourself. You give all for your... Why do you love at all? It's an inconvenience. And there is not a reason. There is not that you do it with a purpose. You do it because that is your nature. And love is its own justification. So when we ask why the One manifests diversity, I think that the closer answer is that it is just its own nature. It doesn't necessarily have to have an intellectual purpose or reason. But the idea is that the One is conscious and has this divine consciousness, and it is just like there is so much potentiality. How would you express something that is infinite? By producing through finite things, by producing an infinite variety of expressions. So there seems to be a natural tendency for an infinite abstract principle to show itself in an infinite number of separate things. So it's like part of its own nature. And then in the Theosophical view, each one of these seeds become a One principle in itself that will repeat the process.
Thank you very much, Pablo.
Okay, thank you.